accession number 28639, reel 1.
So if you're ready, we can start.
Okay.
So this is Jack Hewison, reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Edinburgh, 1919, 14 September.
And what kind of family did you, I mean, was what was your father's job?
Well, my father was a rubber mill worker when they made the old-fashioned golf balls. And he died when I was 12 years of age. And in those days, the family's got no help from the government. So I had no option but to ask permission to leave school at 12. And after an examination, they allowed me to leave school. And I took a job on as a... Well, I played football at the time for a local amateur club called Murrayfield Amateurs in Edinburgh.
At the age of 12?
And sorry?
At 12 you played football?
Football, yes.
At 12 years old?
Sorry?
You, at the age of 12 you
at
played?
At 12, yes, I did. Oh, yes. Yes, I did. I played... I was a big lad for 12 years of age, really. And I got a job as a window dresser, oddly enough. In those days, you know, it was quite common for people of my age to take jobs to help out their family income. And I got a job with the chap who ran the football club I was a member of. He had a chain of grocery shops and he trained me to be a window dresser. And I used to go around the shops. Mind you, that was when I grew older, 14, 15, 16. And I did this for several years.
This was during the period of the Great Depression, wasn't
That's
it?
That's right, yes, exactly.
And what do you remember of those days?
Well, not very much, because I was too busy in my own little world, really. Just helping out my mother and two young brothers I had. Both of them, my brothers are dead now, and I'm the oldest one, I'm still here. The youngest one died 5 years ago of leukemia. And the second brother died at 18 years of age. He was a Highland dancer like my father was. And he was dancing in front of the King and Queen at the Glasgow Exhibition in 1938. And after the first dance, he developed these pins on his side. But he insisted in doing the sword dance, which is the final dance. And he managed to finish it and then he collapsed. Instead of taking him to the Royal Infirmary in Glasgow, they took him back away up to the scout camp in Montrose in Scotland. By the time he got up there, he was dead.
Of?
He had died of, there was two things. There was, I forget what they call it now. I've forgotten what they call it. I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, it's not important. A ruptured appendix or something
like that. Yeah, it was something like that.
Poor, what a tragedy. It must have been a great blow for you.
Oh, it was indeed, because I was the man of the house at the time. And the odd thing about it was we weren't talking, because I was also very keen on radio, and I built my own little radio set with a crystal, old Cat's Whisker days. And to get a big crystal for a transmitter, I just couldn't afford it. So at 16, I joined the Royal Naval Wireless Auxiliary Reserves in Edinburgh, in Leith Docks. And I got my crystal and built my transmitter. One of the conditions was that I had to appear on a Sunday morning in the reserve fleet operation from my little bedroom in Edinburgh. And the flagship at the time was HMS Nelson, a huge battleship, which was in mothballs, but they still had skeleton crew on board, including radio staff. And they used to call me, and I used to have to answer, give signal strengths, and pass little messages to each other just about the weather, just to keep the thing going. And eventually I was called up for the Abyssinian trouble.
In 1936. So, just to go back, you joined, the reserve was called the Royal Naval...
Wireless Auxiliary Reserves.
And did you have to have a uniform? What was...
Well, no, not on those days. They had a sort of a uniform, but it wasn't a proper uniform. Because when I was called up, they did give me a uniform. But for the first two or three months, I didn't have one. I was in the wireless school down at Portsmouth, and I had a terrible time with the regular sailors who were in uniform, and I was there in civvies.
But you said you were called up in
I was called.
1936, because you were part of the reserve.
That was after. I'm sorry, I'm confusing
That's
you
okay.
here. Yes, I'll start again, I think. I'll get the years right. 1936, that's right. That's when I joined the Naval Reserve.
Yeah.
And after that, several years after it, I had my little radio set going, so I was all right on that. Eventually, in 1938, I was called up by the Navy and down to Portsmouth, and it was for the Abyssinian trouble, which didn't come to any fruition. As it was dying down, the Second World War was building up, so instead of releasing me, they kept me on.
Did you object to this?
Sorry?
Did you mind?
No, I didn't mind, because I was earning money now in the Navy, and I was able to get my mother money, so it was helpful. And my mother, by the way, had eventually got a job as a seamstress with a children's home in Edinburgh. So we were getting on all right for money now. But my first posting was on HMS Courageous.
Sorry, before we go on to that, I just wanted to go, because for these archives, they like to get as much detail about training as they can.
Oh, I see.
What do you remember of your wireless training?
Wireless training?
Yeah. You went down to Portsmouth.
That's right. I was in the wireless school there. And they just, they took me around, teach me how to operate the various types of equipment they had, including what was called ASDICs in those days, a form of, what do they call it?
Sound, I know, it's the thing they used to detect submarines underwater.
That's right.
Bouncing, ultrasound.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was, what was it called again?
Anti-submarine device or something like that. I don't know what ASDIC is.
It'll come to me later, I'm sure. But I've got him out. I'm 86 years of age, so
you're
I'm
doing
having
wonderful.
Trouble.
You're doing wonderful. Don't worry at all. That's great.
Where was I? Was that
there? So you've been down for the wireless. You were talking, they trained you how
to
operate various...
Oh, yes, that's right. I finished up then, I've been posted then to HMS Courageous. And it was there they found that I was no seaman. I used to get sick very easily.
What was HMS Courageous?
HMS Courageous was an aircraft carrier. She was sunk just soon after I joined her, actually. While we were out in the North Sea on exercises, the signal officer kept sending for me and saying, I'm very sorry, but we can't keep you in the main office because you're having all the five other operators sick as well with you. I used to go on duty with a bucket between my legs and my headphones, of course. But I could still do my job, even though I used to vomit occasionally. But eventually, when they came in, they got rid of me. And I was put on board, they put me on to HMS Durban, a cruiser that had just come out of mothballs.
What year are we in now? We're still in...
We're in 1930, early 39 by this time.
Before the declaration.
That's right, before the declaration of war. I was on HMS... They're bringing lots of ships out, getting ready for the war, and they... This HMS Durban was brought out of mothball, and I was on her, and I was on her right up until just going out for exercises until 1939, early 39.
What do you remember of life on that ship before the war?
Well, it was a bit hectic because, again, I was a newcomer to the Navy and didn't know the drill, and they used to pull all sorts of tricks on me. One was to... It was canteen messing, what they called, canteen messing, which meant you had to get the stuff from the canteen and prepare your own meals and then put them up to the kitchen. And they sent me up one day. It was my turn to help with the cooking. I said, I'm not a cook, so I can't help, but I'll help as much as I can. So they said, right, would you go up to the canteen and get a packet of condensed steam? And, of course, in my lack of knowledge, I went out and asked for a packet of condensed steam, and I was made just a fool of. That was one of the many things that happened to me.
But was it a good life? I mean, I just...
Oh, yes, it
pre-war,
was.
Even though you were ribbed, you enjoyed it.
Yes, I enjoyed the Navy very much. It was an education for me, really, having had to leave school so early. I'd made lots of friends as well over the years. And eventually, the Durban then sailed for, at the early part of the war, 1939, before the war was actually declared, actually, that we went out to Freetown, and we were in Freetown in West Africa when the war was declared.
What are your memories of Freetown? I've been there, actually.
Freetown, have you? In those days, it was pretty awful, it was, really.
Not much has changed.
There was nothing there, really. Just a little place for Navy ships to come in and go. And it was while I was there that I was still seasick, and the signal officer was determined to get rid of me. So, I don't know if you know, but in the early part of the war, our RAF was bombing our own submarines. I don't know if you knew that, by mistake. Friendly fire, they call it. It was because there were no signals. They brought out recognition signals later on. But up to that point, the submarine would see an aircraft coming towards it, and it would start to dive. The aircraft would see the submarine dive and just go for it. And this submarine, I can't remember the name of it. I think it was HMS Clyde, but I'm not sure, because most of the subs were called after rivers. She came in, and she had been badly damaged on the conning tower into Freetown, badly damaged conning tower, and the wireless op was one of those killed. So they put me on board her. But as soon as I went on board, I explained to the captain, I said, look, I'll be no use to you, because you don't have passengers, you can't have passengers on a submarine. He says, oh no, you're the one, the man who'll be do all the wireless work. I says, well, I can do that, but I said, I'm a very bad sailor. God knows what I'll be like under the water. I said, I suffer from claustrophobia as well, which doesn't help us in any. So he said, well, we'll be in port for some time, so stay where you are. So I did this, and while I was there, I was helping out with the refitting of the cables and that the wireless had been destroyed by the damage to the conning tower. And by the time she was ready, they had got someone else, so I was off there. And I was back on the Durban again. And we were decking convoys then down to Cape Town.
And war has been declared.
Yeah, but that's down. Well, it was before, when I was in Freetown, it was declared.
Oh, right, okay.
When I was in Freetown, it was declared. And that was when the submarine came in, you see, soon afterwards. It had been badly damaged. Anyway, we were down in Cape Town then, and at a place called, now what was the naval base just round the corner from that? Oh, I've forgotten the name of it now. Oh dear.
Can't help you there, I'm afraid.
I'll come to me again shortly.
No worries.
If you'd told me, you know, earlier that you were going back this, I would have given some thought to it. Anyway, it's a naval base just round the corner from Cape Town, and we were there for several months, taking convoys, I say, up to Freetown and bringing them back down again. And on one occasion, when we came back into Cape Town, we were allowed up from this naval base up to Cape Town on leave. But the war now had intensified by this time.
Do you have any idea where we are now? Are we in 1940 yet?
1940, early 40,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Early 40. And the Scharnhorst, not the battleship, but there was a merchant ship of the same name. She was reporting in the area. So we were told to stand by, to go out if need be, to look for her. But we were still allowed leave up to Cape Town from this naval base. And up we went to Cape Town, and I booked in at the YMCA in Cape Town to stay overnight. When we woke up the next morning, got the train back, half past six in the morning, back into the naval base. When we arrived at the naval base, our ship had gone. So there were six Marines there waiting to arrest 12 of us. And they put us in the naval cells there until our ship came back. And when she came back, they were taken on board and put in cells there on the ship. And when we were at sea, the naval skipper then had us up on a charge for deserting the ship. We tried to plead innocence because of what had happened, but no way. So they gave each of us 5 days' cells on board the ship, and that was awful, that was. We were allowed up in the afternoon for exercise on the forecastle, and on the forecastle where people was in the tropics, you see, so the sailors were lying resting in the afternoon. So they would go up and kick people with this Marines to make a passage for us to walk up and down for exercising. And you can imagine the comments from some of the people who are trying to get a rest there. By the way, we had to wear boots without any laces and things like this, or shoes without any laces, because they might damage ourselves. But one of the great things that happened during that period was the Royal Marines used to stand outside each cell. And on this occasion, this Marine said to me, "You've got to take one of these." They give us a length of rope, about that length. And
about a foot long, yeah.
That's right. We had to beat this. We had to tear this apart. It's what they used to pack in the hammocks. That's the hammocks. What mattress for the hammocks? But they also used them. I don't know if you know this. If there was a chip was holed, they used to take. That's why they used to lash the hammocks like a sausage. It's because they could pack the holes with this thing. Also, of course, it was useful for stacking away. But anyway, this Royal Marine said, "Don't worry about taking it." He says, "Your fingernails will hurt like hell." He says, "Wait till night time. I'll be on duty and I'll show you how to do this." He says, "But you must do it quietly, as quietly as you can." I thought, how can I do that in a cell? Anyway, when they came on at night, he said, "Now take one end of this piece of rope," he said, "and belt the dividing part of the panels, which becomes in the way of the ship's side. Each panel came in the way where it was welded."
Mm-hmm.
"Now," he said, "beat that bit." He says, "that won't echo." So I did this. And, of course, all the stuff flew up. So I had my... And they used to give me chocolate and things. So although I was on dry bread and a cherry of all things, all sorts of peculiar things they gave us in that cell during the 5 days.
How did you cope with claustrophobia and seasickness if you were in a cell?
It was the nightmares. It was awful. I just couldn't stand it. I used to just come out in terrible sweats, and these Marines were so kind to me, looking through the grill, you know, and telling me what to do, and don't worry about it. And they kept talking to me, which helped a lot as well. And eventually I'd fall asleep and they would leave me. But they were very, very good. That was one of the good things about the Navy, by the way, was the brotherhood that you found between the officers as well in a lot of cases, except this captain of this Durban. Because by the time we got to Singapore, I must tell you, when we finished our period in Cape Town, we were then drafted to Singapore.
On the ship, on the same
ship. On the Durban, that's right.
Before we go ahead of that, I just wanted the escorting duties that the ship carried out.
Oh, yes.
Did you ever, was there any enemy contact?
We had a reported submarine, but we dropped death charges and it must have scared it away because it didn't, we might have got it, I don't know. But we didn't actually see any submarine surface.
And you were working in the signals office of the ship.
I was in the signals office most of the time, that's right.
Still vomiting into your bucket.
Oh, that's right, exactly. Yes, I was.
And what were you using, Morse code? What was the...
Yeah, Morse code. Oh, yes, Morse code, that's right. We didn't have voice in those days. It was Morse code. And it was the old telegraph type key, not the bunk key, because the bunk keys came in later. But they used to damage the relays. The relays weren't strong enough to take the speed that these bunk keys used to work on. It used to do press for a dot and this for dashes, and that dot, dash, dot, 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 I just do this with thumb and forefinger. But we used to use the post office type keys, which the RAF used on their knees up in the aircraft.
Did they develop a way of communicating with submarines? You said there was that problem of...
Well, as far as I know, they did, because we never had any more problems after that. But that was the one case I definitely remember, when it was due to this anti... recognition signals that we didn't have at the time.
So, and you were now an able seaman?
I was a trained officer, trained officer on the wireless section.
Trained operator?
Trained operator, that's right.
Right.
Wireless. Later I became a leading telegraphist. But at that time, I was just a trained operator, having been trained at the wireless school in Portsmouth. But
so we're now, yes, so sorry, now we're going to go back. You were saying, so you finished up in South Africa, and this is now still
on
early.
The way to Singapore. We were then drafted to Singapore.
And this is early 1940.
Say May. 42, 43, 1940. Yes, early 40. It would be January, February, March, around that period that we were transferred up to Singapore. Because we only got halfway there when the engines backed in. We floated around the Indian Ocean for God knows how long. And that was awful. We were floating from side to side. And that's when they decided that I could no longer stay in the wireless office because it was awful there. I was disturbing all the other officers in there. So they put me down in this little office. It was down below the bilges on the ship.
Below the bilges?
Below the bilges, yes. And this was the idea of this was that I was to stay down there. I was battened down, by the way. I could only get out by getting someone to open this hatch to let me out. And I was there as a last resort to keep sending the SOSs with the position of the ship. I had a voice communication with the bridge. Well, that was my job down there.
For someone who suffers from claustrophobia,
I know, and
seasickness.
It couldn't have been worse for me. It was just, I think this all helped make me what I was later on. I was almost insane, really, with it. It was just a terrible state I was in, really, even before the Japanese got to me. But anyway, by the time we got to Singapore, they said, you've got to go, you've got to go to another ship. But before they could do this, we were then transferred to Hong Kong. So while I was in, the short time I was in Singapore, we were up the Burma coast and we were helping with the dropping of supplies and that to the people who were getting ready for the Japanese invasion of Burma. But mind you, they hadn't even got that far yet, but they were prepared for it, getting prepared for it.
These were British troops?
British troops were being posted up up the Burma coast there.
And so how did that work? The ship moored off and stuff was ferried in?
No, we couldn't get in board. We had to do everything by bringing boats out and using our own motor boats, our own motor-type boats. But we didn't land any soldiers. They all were already there. I don't know where they came from, but we didn't take any out. We just took supplies up.
And they were British soldiers?
They were British soldiers, oh yes, they were.
Marines, or were they a special detachment?
Well, I have no idea. We didn't meet them because we were on board the ship. We were just taking supplies up to them.
Did you didn't go ashore with any of these boats?
No.
They
came
out to you?
That's right, they came out to us, that's right. And then back to Singapore again, and then we were off to Hong Kong. And halfway, we got up to Hong Kong. All right, we arrived in Hong Kong. Early 41.
Early 41.
Early 41.
Before we go on to that, against my fault, I should have asked. The engine failure on the Durban in the middle of the Indian Ocean, you said the ship's engines failed.
That's right.
She was powered by what? By steam turbines? And
I think they were. Coal? No, they weren't coal. Wait a minute now. I can't remember, honestly. I can't remember whether they were coal. We used to steam a lot, I know that, because they used to leave smoke when they used to hide themselves. They used to let smoke come out. So there must have been some sort of coal or steam or something like that. I don't know how to do. But smoke, it suggests coal, doesn't it? Really?
It does. Well, it could be oil. I don't know enough about it. No, I was just curious. And so they managed to fix this problem after out at sea.
That's right, yes. They managed to fix the engine and off we went again into Singapore and then up the Burma coast.
Right.
And then back to Singapore again, and from there to Hong Kong.
What were your impressions of Singapore? Did you go ashore there?
No, I didn't. No, we never got ashore in Singapore. We were just in and out, really, all the time. But when we got to Hong Kong, that's when they were determined to get rid of me. And they did. They got me onto Stonecutters Wireless, Naval Wireless Station, Stonecutters it was called. RNWT Station, Stonecutters. And I was put on there, and from there I was loaned out if any of the ships in the harbour needed assistance in wireless software. For instance, I was once on the one of the oil tankers, the Apple Leaf, I remember her, the Apple Leaf. And it was one of the times on the Apple Leaf, we were up to refuel the Liverpool, which was stationed in Hong Kong, but was up patrolling the China coast, looking, just keeping an eye on the Japanese fleet at the time. This is before the Japanese declared war on us. And after 2 months on that, we came back in again. And then, well, with the one morning, the 8 o'clock in the morning, it was on Christmas morning, I remember that, 1941, the air raid sirens went and overcame the Japanese planes. And I'd just come off night shift on Stonecutters Island, and I was still in my pyjamas, but they'd already given me the posting in the event of an air raid. So I was in this little surrounded sort of circle of sandbags with my machine gun, and still in my pyjamas with my helmet on, firing at these dive bombers, the Japanese dive bombers, as they came down. And that only lasted about an hour the first time. So off they went, and we didn't see them again for 2 or 3 days after that.
So this was Christmas Day in 1941?
That was Christmas Day.
And did they do much damage?
Oh, wait a minute now. I'm sorry, I'm misleading you here.
Don't worry.
Because that was when we surrendered, Christmas Day 1941. No, it would be, wait a minute, oh dear, when did they declare war now?
Well, I, to tell you the truth, I can't.
It would be,
when was Pearl Harbor?
About 8th of December, I think it was. It was early in December, anyway.
Of 1941.
And 1941, yeah.
Okay, well, that's all right, that's okay.
It was early December 41 when war was declared, that was it. And it was soon after that that the air raid came, and I was in this little pool of sandbags with my machine gun. And soon after that, the MTB flotilla, the second MTB flotilla, was stationed in Hong Kong, and one of their wireless operators had taken seriously ill and had to be taken to Naval Hospital, Hong Kong. So I was put on number 8, MTB, not 8. And I was...
Before we... Just again, I wanted to get what your impressions were of Hong Kong at that time.
Well,
I
mean, initial impressions were lovely.
It was a shore base.
It was shore base,
so you weren't
yes.
having to bring your bucket with you.
That's right, exactly. It was lovely. I was on Stonecutters Island, of course, and although it was an island, it was like being on a ship, because every time we wanted to get ashore, we had to go by a boat. And
but the food was good, the quality of life was better, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. And it was a paradise in the old days. No longer a paradise, because I've been back since. And it's not the same Hong Kong as I remember. It was a real tropical paradise in those days. And the Chinese were lovely people. I'm still very fond of Chinese, because I got to know so many of them there. And
that's fine. Are you okay? Do you want to have a break? Are you all right?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind a little cup of coffee.
Go for it. I'm sorry. Yeah, let you do that. Don't worry. There's no rush at all.
Anyway, where was I now? Oh yes, you were telling me Hong Kong. I loved Repulse Bay, a place like that. We used to go swimming. I don't know if you know Hong Kong at all, but Repulse Bay on the seaward side of Hong Kong. There's Repulse Bay, and that actually had bitter memories later on in life to me, because it, as I'll tell you later on, but at that time of my period in Hong Kong, it was brilliant to go down there and just bathe and lie in the sun, and it was really just, all this time we were getting news of what was happening in Europe and all that, and to think we were out there on a tropical island enjoying the sun. But later on, of course, as I say, I was eventually put on the motor torpedo boats.
The motor torpedo boats, what, had a crew of maybe, what, 10?
Oh, 7 or 8.
7 or 8. There was,
yes, that's right.
60 feet
we
long.
We used to have an officer in charge of the boat. There was myself as a wireless operator, and I used to sit on the conning tower beside the skipper, because I was the one that had to do all the manoeuvres, pass the manoeuvres to the other boat, or from the leading boat, receiving instructions. And there was a coxswain who did all the steering of the boat. There was two seamen and a cook, a Chinese cook. The two seamen were also torpedo people. We had 4 torpedoes, 2 in a tube and 2 spares, and 4 depth charges on the upper deck, 3 Thornycroft engines. I remember those, if they were, I remember these things distinctly because of the problems we had with them. But 3 Thornycroft engines, very powerful, with 3 propellers, of course. And they were very powerful boats, I'll tell you, they were a lovely time that was. That I wasn't seasick anymore because they used to go so fast, they didn't roll over straight to die.
Jack Hewison, Reel 2.